June 1940, a young, dashing secret agent with a taste for fast women and faster cars was sent by British Naval Intelligence on a secret mission to war-torn Paris. Unlocking the MI6 safe, he took the cash and drove south to evacuate British refugees escaping Nazi occupation. This is not the fictional story of the quintessential British spy, James Bond, but the true story of his creator, Ian Fleming.
Joanna Lumley stands at her window at the top of the London Gherkin building and looks across the city.
Ian Fleming revolutionised the British spy thriller. And the way he wrote them, that extraordinary punchy way of written with energy, short sentences, packed with detail and glamour and obsession, this managed to create one of the most enduring heroes of all time.
Shimmering digits reading 007, a laser, explosions, car chases and high adventure.
Everyone knows Bond from the films, but it all began with the books. To date, over 100 million have been sold.
Bond elegantly tosses a hat.
Ian Fleming had always dreamt of becoming a celebrated author. But it took almost his whole life before he began to write Bond at the age of 43. First, Fleming himself had to experience a life rich in adventure before the fantastical world of Bond could emerge. And when it did, it was the perfect tonic for 1950s Britain.
Joanna travels along the Thames on a speedboat.
I, like so many others, am a fan of James Bond. In 1969, I even came face to face with him. And since then, I've continued to be fascinated by Ian Fleming, the man who created this mesmeric hero.
Ian Fleming, where Bond began. Exotic flowers.
It was here, in Jamaica, in 1952, that the world's most famous secret agent was created, when Ian Fleming finally found the space to recall his life's adventures.
All these observations are really, of course, observations of my own, which I put into Bond's mouth. I can say it's 90% from personal experience, really, and I'm rather amused, of course, to put forward my own little quirks in prose.
Writing all of the 14 Bond books here, Fleming adhered to a strict regime. After his morning swim on the reef, he breakfasted on scrambled eggs in the garden and made his way to his study. Fleming himself said, "Would these books have been born if I hadn't been living in the gorgeous vacuum of a Jamaican holiday? I doubt it." This is where he wrote. He'd shut these blinds, jalousie they were called, to shut out the light. Then he would sit here, 20-year-old Imperial typewriter, and he would start tapping away. He would 3 hours, never reading back, pages out, putting down. It's quite extraordinary to think that out of this corner came M, Moneypenny, Scaramanga, Oddjob, came Blofeld. Everybody spilled and fumed out of this corner. Out they came. Just in this one little corner of this one house, this one hill, in Jamaica, half a world away. Ian Fleming was born in 1908 into a family steeped in wealth and privilege. Right from the outset, his experiences would shape his future life as a writer. Under the domineering influence of his beautiful and creative mother, Evelyn, Fleming's idyllic childhood was scarred by the sudden death of his father. Valentine Fleming died on the battlefields of France in World War I when Fleming was just 8 years old. In the books, Bond is orphaned at 11. Ben McIntyre has been writing about how Fleming's whole life infuses his art.
Fleming bases this extraordinary run of fiction. In reality, everything I write, he said, has a precedent in truth. Everything is traceable back to something that Fleming himself experienced or was told about or had seen or had tasted or had witnessed. Fleming was a tremendous magpie. of a writer. He used to gather his material from everywhere, bit by bit. Fleming kept these wonderful notebooks, sketches, menus, names, headlines, little bits of information. These are really the mother lode of James Bond. That is where an awful lot of the material comes from. When Fleming describes a place, describes a food, you can be pretty sure that he's been there and he's eaten it. And so that gives these books a tremendous verve and a tremendous believability, I think, that is really, was certainly unique for the time and has ensured that he really does still feel real.
It was here at Eton College that Fleming's passion for literature began. As well as being a successful athlete, twice winning the top sports prize, the Victor Ludorum, he spent his time reading Scarlet Pimpernel and Bulldog Drummond novels, and even trying his hand at short stories. Librarian Michael Meredith has found evidence that the first Bond-like plots could have originated here.
Ian actually was the main editor of this, which is The Wyvern. And in it is a short story that he wrote, very much on the James Bond pattern.
The first published Ian Fleming short story.
That's right. With a very dramatic title, The Ordeal of Carol St. George. Have you read it?
No, I haven't.
Because it is the most extraordinary story. Now, let me tell you straight away, it starts with a bang. A man called Paul St. George goes back to his very smart London house in the West End, goes to his study, looks in a drawer, pulls out his field revolver and shoots himself.
Was he an accomplished writer even then, do you think?
I wouldn't say accomplished, but it's a pretty good piece of schoolboy writing, yes.
The echoes of the shot crashed round the room and seemed to roll round the whole house before all was again silent. Good stuff.
It is.
How old was he, do you think, when he wrote this?
17.
17?
Yes, not bad.
And a shilling. Now, that was quite expensive in those days.
Yes, it was. And I think that Ian made £60 out of this, which is a lot of money.
I mean,
we're talking about 1920s, so I think he probably had some good times with that £60.
Do you think any aspects of Eton made their way into the Bond books?
Apparently, there was a boy called Scaramanga. I don't know very much about Scaramanga. He's not at all well known. But rumour has it that he and Fleming didn't like one another, and that's why Scaramanga is put later on into the Bond novels with three nipples, you remember.
In the Bond stories, the villain has quite a sort of patriarchal role. Do you think that's something to do with him getting his own back on a headmaster?
I don't think it could possibly be the headmaster, but on the other hand, I don't know very much about his housemaster, Evie Slater, but rumour has it that he was quite a sadist. And it is just possible that there may be something of Evie Slater in some of the Bond villains.
I thought you less stupid. Usually when a man gets in my way.
Bond's nemesis crushes a gold statue.
Bond's ability to trip up patronising villains in the books and later the films continues to have an instant appeal to every grown-up schoolboy who still dreams of kicking the school bully in the groin.
At school, it's easy to pick out one's own villains and heroes, and one grows up wanting to be a hero and kill the villains.
A henchman skewered on a harpoon.
I think he got the point.
Although Fleming clearly had a writer's sensibility, after school his dreams were thrown off course. First, his mother wanted him to pursue a military career and sent him to Sandhurst. But there, the strict regime and square bashing was at odds with Fleming's relaxed personality. He was dismissed in less than a year. So at 19, Fleming was urged to apply to the Foreign Office. Packed off to Austria for 6 months to prepare for the exam, he learned three languages fluently, how to ski beautifully, and seduce the local girls effortlessly. All great for a future Bond, but not perhaps for an aspiring diplomat. Fleming didn't make the grade. Running out of options, Fleming decided to pursue his passion for writing. 20 years before he invented Bond, he became a journalist at Reuters, the international news agency. And it was here Fleming learned to develop his writing skills, saying, accuracy, speed and facts, the more exciting, the better. To mark the centenary of Fleming's birth, author Sebastian Foakes has written a new James Bond novel, Devil May Care, in Fleming's style.
The first book I read was From Russia with Love, and on the back there was a picture of Tatiana Romanova wearing a sort of turquoise dress slashed to the waist with sort of black stockings underneath, and this was a lot better than Latin.
What kind of literary tricks did Fleming use?
Fleming's style is essentially very straightforward. It's a journalistic style. It's dinned into you by some brutal news editor. Don't bang on too long. You have to get the information over quickly and clearly, and this means using short sentences, lots of main active verbs. It means no adverbs ever, very few adjectives, no semicolons. If you feel that you can't get it all into one sentence, put in a full stop and have another one. And this style is extremely effective in describing action.
He made a dive for Blofeld's neck and got both hands to it. For a moment, the two sweating faces were almost up against each other. The boss of Blofeld's sword battered into Bond's side. Bond hardly felt the crashing blows.
There's also a question of tone, which is the author's own attitude towards his subject matter, which is rather harder to define. That's something that just sort of leaks into the sentences. And Ian Fleming had a way of talking to you as the reader, which was to say, you don't really understand this because you're just a sort of poor housebound or school-bound little reader. But James Bond and I, we've been to these places. You know, we understand fast cars, glamorous women, powerful cocktails. And there was something rather condescending about the way that he was talking to you. But at the same time, you felt very privileged, I think, to be part of that world.
Working as a journalist at Reuters enabled Fleming not only to hone his writing skills, but to travel to far-flung places. In 1933, Fleming was sent to Russia. The oppressive, granite-faced communism he encountered later proved rich material for his books. With the chutzpah of youth, Fleming even requested an interview with Stalin, but received a note saying he was simply too busy.
8.6 miles an hour.
A race car.
Fleming was fascinated by cars from an early age. And whilst at Reuters, he revelled in the opportunity to report on international motor racing.
Bond raced back to his car, whipped it into third, and went after him. The deep note of his 2-inch exhaust thundered back at him. The tyres screamed on the tarmac.
Fleming loved to describe the experience of driving, the speed, the power, the beauty of the machine. And as with all his detailed and evocative descriptions, he wanted the reader to feel that they were right here in the driver's seat, right where I'm sitting.
Joanna looks very pleased with herself as she speeds off.
She went like a bird and a bomb, and Bond loved her more than all the women at present in his life rolled, if that was feasible, together.
A black and white photograph of a young Fleming.
Fleming was loving journalism, but not its salary. A year after joining Reuters, he asked for his pay to be doubled, saying, "This is a materialistic age, and the day is past when a career was merely a hobby." In truth, Fleming's wealthy grandfather had just died, and he had inherited little. So for 5 years, he tried his luck as a stockbroker. But this was not a good move. Although always a gambler, numbers left him cold. But all was about to change.
Bombs spilling from the belly of a plane, ground assault weapons, and parachutists leaping from aircraft.
On the 1st of September 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Britain and France declared war 2 days later. Until now, Fleming had seemed bound, not for literary immortality, but the life of a privileged, well-heeled dilettante, destined to disappear under the shadow of unfulfilled potential. For Fleming, the outbreak of war was, in retrospect, a godsend. Admiral John Godfrey, director of naval intelligence based in Whitehall, had put out the word he needed help. Fleming's mother had written to Churchill, extolling her son's abilities, and soon Fleming was at the top of Godfrey's list.
Fleming got the job as Admiral Godfrey's personal assistant, an enviable position at the core of wartime naval intelligence. Here it was that his eyes were opened to the murky world of double agents, secret documents, and deadly missions. Now known only by the code name 17F, Fleming worked here in room 39.
Points are marked on a vast map.
Naval intelligence was responsible for tracking U-boats, running secret agents, and providing counterintelligence to the Royal Navy for the war at sea. Fleming's charm and irreverence was a breath of fresh air for his new boss, Admiral Godfrey, known for his irascible and blunt temperament. Years later, Godfrey's characteristics would translate into Fleming's fictional head of the Secret Service, otherwise known as M. This is room 39. It's much bigger than I thought. Oh, look. This is the fireplace where that iconic photograph was taken. Commander Fleming standing beside it. I recognise that. I think that it would have looked quite different because this has got quite a relaxed, kind of slightly girly feeling to it. Lots of things, stuff left behind. I think it would have been more regimented desks. They wouldn't have had these curved desks in the old days. And the buzz of stuff that was going on here, documents coming in, people taking stuff to and fro, people receiving information, filing it. Oh, look, just near this filing cabinet, here's the door. This was the door through to Admiral Godfrey. So Ian Fleming, when he was called, I say Fleming, and he goes, yes, and he'd have gone in through here. But of course, later on, this would have been the door that Bond would have been summoned for M.
007.
Look, here's the picture. No, I think he looks like a jolly attractive man. Slim, fit, well-dressed, hair neatly combed back, man with a mission. Man with a finger on the pulse. Man who suddenly found his place in life. Admiral Godfrey encouraged Fleming's imaginative flair and assigned him to dream up espionage plans to confound the Germans. His ideas included forging Reichsmarks to disrupt the German economy, floating a radio ship in the North Sea to broadcast depressing propaganda to the Germans. And it was for the codebreakers at Bletchley Park that Fleming concocted one of his most ingenious and outlandish plots. Operation Ruthless was Fleming's scheme to seize the codebook for the German naval Enigma machine. He proposed that British airmen, disguised as Luftwaffe crew, would crash a captured bomber in the channel in order to lure a German rescue vessel to their aid, then shoot the crew and capture the codebook. This daring exploit to capture a decoding machine later turned up in From Russia with Love.
The brand new Spectre machine. The thing we'd give our eyes to have. God, said Bond softly, his mind boggling at the immensity of the prize. The Spectre. The machine that would allow them to decipher top secret traffic.
Ultimately, Admiral Godfrey abandoned the plan as too dangerous, but it had given Fleming the opportunity to meet Charles Fraser Smith, responsible for conjuring up ingenious gadgets for secret agents and saboteurs. Later, Fleming introduced Q Branch to do the same for Bond.
This picture here on his pass is the only picture ever taken of my father from the early, well, mid-40s when he joined the service up until the time when he came out in 48. Because he didn't exist.
It's activated by nerve impulses from the wrist muscles.
Like this?
A shaving brush.
Yes.
Out comes the bristle with the amount of cement very much shortened.
Yes.
You've got a lot of space. That is a map which could fit in.
No.
But behind that could also go one of these compasses. You look inside, you can just see.
Beautiful little compass. Look at it swinging round to find true north. And it goes anti-clockwise to screw it up.
Mm.
And somebody's coming, so we get this water hot, the foam ready, like la-la. Guten Morgen.
Q Branch had put together this smart-looking little bag to pack 50 rounds of .25 ammunition between the leather and the lining of the spine. In each of the innocent sides, there was a flat throwing knife.
Chocolat Meunier.
Chocolate. Meunier chocolate. A lot of the French diet was very heavily laced with garlic. Well, it's no good being an English agent and arriving and not only not smelling of garlic, but not even exuding it somehow through the pores. So what they did was the gritty bits were, in fact, heavily laced garlic. They'd eat it for a day or two, and after which then they'd be into the garlic regime.
Taken for a Frenchman. What is this map?
Well, this is France, but it was an ordinary white handkerchief. Nothing wrong with it, plain white handkerchief. So all we did with this, put it bluntly, was drop it on the ground and pee on it.
And that brought out...
And that brought out the line. The impregnation of the map with the uric acid would do it. You could then wash it out,
yeah,
stuff it away, and then...
And then you've got your map.
You got it, and then you've got a plain handkerchief again.
It goes back to white again?
Yeah.
And then when you piddle on it again, yeah, it comes
You can
up.
Do that three or four times, after
so this
which...
So is piddled.
The gadgetry of Fraser Smith fired Fleming's imagination. Later, the villains in his books would conceal weapons in the most unlikely places. A gun inside Tolstoy's greatest works, a pistol disguised as a keyhole in Mr. Big's desk, and Rosa Klebb's poison blade shoes.
What? Bond fends Klebb off with a chair.
Top secret files chronicling Fleming's work are kept here at the National Archives in London. Historian James Taylor has been investigating just how much of Fleming's wartime experience was later translated into the Cold War fiction of James Bond.
The Second World War in particular informs the books hugely. A lot of the villains, of course, are Germans.
Yes.
Or have German-sounding names.
Yes.
Blofeld being one example.
Indeed.
His mountain hideaway would instantly evoke to any reader at that time,
yeah,
Hitler's own hideaway at Berchtesgaden. So Fleming is using shorthand here to reawaken readers' fears in many ways. Another example, Irma Bunt would instantly evoke Irma Graeser, who was the Belsen concentration camp guard hanged in 1946.
And where did the 007 tag come from?
Fleming openly acknowledged that he pinched it, that was his word, from documents, Admiralty documents, that were most secret or top secret. And we can see here...
Most secret, NID, which means...
Naval Intelligence Division.
002.
What he did was take the 00, and Bond is made 007. That means that he has the licence to kill.
Fleming may have got the job through family connections, but soon he became indispensable. He was even appointed to answer Churchill's urgent intelligence requests. Admiral Godfrey later said of Fleming, I shared all secrets with him so that if I got knocked out, someone else would be left to pick up the bits.
Some of these documents relate directly to one organisation which he set up, which was called 30 Assault Unit. And this was probably his, I suppose, his main contribution to the direction of the Second World War. The role of this commando unit was to go out and seize important enemy materials before they could be destroyed. So this would be secret weaponry, this could be secret documents, anything like that. You can see here some very Bond-like skills, special demolition work here.
Yes.
Safe breaking, one of the more interesting skills that they're supposed to acquire.
See Commander Rhodes on escaping technique.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And there's also suggested reading, if we look over the page. Out of the Night by Valtine, The American Black Chamber by Yardley, and The German Secret Service by Nicolai.
Officers and men should be encouraged to read novels and books on intelligence work, of which the following ones are good ones.
Yeah.
And this
yeah.
has got the F for Fleming written down here
yeah,
again.
Yeah, indeed.
It's already starting to have a slightly fictional quality.
Yes,
to it,
it is. Fleming always said that Bond was actually an amalgam of the tough commando types that he encountered during the Second World War, and without doubt, when he was talking about tough commando types, he was talking about 30 Assault Unit. Yeah. They showed immense pluck and guile and resourcefulness, and very British characteristics, of course, which, again, Fleming in the novels shows, because we can't match these military-industrial complexes that the Soviet Union and the United States have, but good old British, you know, resourcefulness is what you need here, and that's what pushes Bond up to the top.
Look at this paragraph 4. Proceed with second or third wave of attack into the port. Make straight for the various buildings, etc.,
yeah,
where the booty is expected to be found.
Yeah.
Sounds piratical.
Yes.
Capture it and return.
Yeah.
This, number 6, Operation Sledgehammer. It's terribly sort of thrilling stuff.
It is. It has the whiff of the public schoolboy about it.
Yes.
Again, it's daring do, albeit with a very, very serious purpose.
Yes.
These people were not just playing games. I think that's important to stress.
Yes.
But the tone of this document sometimes suggests otherwise. Fleming is clearly enjoying this.
Explosions and fires being put out.
As the Blitz raged above, London society carried on. When not in the smoky hive of the Admiralty, Fleming's life was filled with dates, dinners and illicit affairs. Fleming dated Muriel Wright, whom he called Mew, or Honeytop, on account of her striking blonde hair. She was a fresh-faced English rose and became the ultimate blueprint for his Bond girls.
She was an athletic-looking girl whom Bond would have casually associated with tennis or skating or show jumping. She had the sort of firm, compact figure that always attracted him, and a fresh, open-air type of prettiness that would have been commonplace but for a wide, rather passionate mouth. It was clear from the undisguised curves of her breasts and hips that she had little on underneath.
Mew was obsessed by Fleming. She would carry his golf clubs, collect his custom-made cigarettes, and even took up a job at the Admiralty to be near him. Tragically, one night Muriel was killed in an air raid. Fleming was summoned from the card table to identify the body. Distraught at the rather cavalier way he had treated her, he refused to return to the London haunts they'd visited together, and he wore Mew's bracelet on his keyring. One of Ian's associates remarked meanly, "The trouble with Ian is that you have to get yourself killed before he feels anything." But in truth, the death of Muriel had a profound effect on Fleming's emotions, and memories of her death would emerge later.
She was lying forward, with her face buried in the ruins of the steering wheel. Bond put his arm around her shoulders, across which the dark patches had begun to flower. Bond's head sank down against hers, and he whispered into her hair, "You see, we've got all the time in the world."
Bond girls are the stuff of legend. In 1969, I played the English girl, one of Blofeld's angels of death, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. We all thought Bond must be impervious to female charms, as we were pretty irresistible, and he appeared to be unmoved.
"Of course, I know what he's allergic to."
It was all impossibly glamorous. The location in Switzerland, the clothes, the pizzazz. I loved every second of it.
She held her body proudly, her fine breasts outthrown and unashamed under the taut silk. Her stance, with feet slightly parted and hands behind her back, was a mixture of provocation and challenge.
The qualities Bond most admires in a woman are both physical and practical. Gold hair, grey eyes, a sinful mouth, a perfect figure. Bond also expects his ideal woman to be able to make a béarnaise sauce as well as she makes love. Although, presumably not at the same time. Although, I of course can. And do. Frequently. The most long-lasting and significant relationship in Fleming's life was to be the vivacious, witty, and intelligent Anne Charteris. They first met before the war and were immediately attracted to each other. She noted in her diary that Fleming was a handsome, moody creature. Although Anne was married at the time, their relationship developed during the Blitz. Unlike many of Fleming's doting admirers, she was confident, single-minded, and would often tease him, calling him a chocolate sailor, all glamour and no action. Fleming, although in love with her, preferred bachelorhood and refused to commit.
After 6.5 years in naval intelligence, Fleming was no longer the restless young man he had been in 1939. He'd found a world of adventure, violence and intrigue which delighted him, satisfying his intellect and romanticism and, most crucially, stimulating his desire to write. And in 1944, when he was in France, he said to a colleague, "When this war is over, I am going to write the spy story to end all spy stories," which he did, but not for another 7 years.
Fleming was proud of his secret contribution to victory, but his ambitions for peacetime fame were still a long way off. He was pleased to return to journalism with an extremely well-paid job at the Sunday Times. For the rest of his life, his work here would complement and inspire Bond, and give him the means to create the perfect place to write.
Tropical waters and palm fronds.
Yes, Jamaica was paradise, all right. While in their homeland, people munched their spam, fiddled in the black market, cursed the government, and suffered the worst winter weather for 30 years.
Joanna is on board a boat cruising the glittering waters surrounding the island. Houses nestle on the hillsides.
In 1946, he bought this plot of land behind me. It had been a donkey racetrack, and here he built his house. He gave it the code name of a wartime operation, Goldeneye. It was here that he found the relaxation and the solitude to start writing. He'd fallen completely in love with Jamaica. He was to remain under its spell for the rest of his life.
Just because you're big and fat, you won't come take me.
Every year from January to March, Fleming came here to revel in his private tropical hideaway, pursuing his passion for underwater exploring, learning about the flora and fauna, and socializing with his new neighbor, Noel Coward.
It is not, strictly speaking, a very comfortable house. I used to call it bed and board because the beds were so hard. I had a wonderful time. The rent was extremely high.
Anne also came to visit, and in Christmas 1951, they discovered she was pregnant with Fleming's child. Her husband, knowing of their romance and mindful of his own infidelities, had already granted her a divorce.
I'm fed up with all these untidy, casual affairs that leave me with a bad conscience. I wouldn't mind having children. Bond found his voice saying those words that he'd never said in his life before. Will you marry me?
17 years after they first met, self-confessed bachelor Ian Fleming finally asked Anne to marry him. Now the elements in Fleming's life were at last in place. At the age of 43, he began his first Bond book, Casino Royale, a story of high-stakes gambling, Soviet spies, and a double-crossing woman. Fleming joked that he began typing to take his mind off his forthcoming marriage. But in truth, waiting for Anne's divorce to come through afforded Fleming the time and space to recall all the ideas, plots, and people he'd been collecting for years.
These are Fleming's little notebooks he used to write. Anything that passed through his head, just some of its pieces of narrative, some of it's just a name, something to remind him. Bond, he's put a B at the top, so presumably Bond says, if any man asks how old you are, look thoughtful and sincere, and say, in the early 40s. It's very charming, I must remember that. In this notebook, it seems, I think Fleming would have made a fantastic copywriter for ads. In this entire book, everything is to do with Booth's high and dry gin. And he's got little scenes between he and she. He loves these gins. She, why do you always ask for Booth's high and dry? He, because it's as smooth as your hips and as clear as your eyes. And she says, probably simpering, phooey. She, gin and bitter lemon, please. Ask him for Booth's high and dry. He, you seem to know what you want. She, not only what? Very tasty. And here another little one, Century Notebook, little humble ones, in here, little scraps of paper. Le Tip Top, name of a club. Pricey job you've got there. Quantum of Solace. Nothing, just that. Quantum of Solace.
Fleming wrote all of the 14 Bond books here. Jamaica gave him the opportunity to write, and its natural beauty was his inspiration. The landscape finds its way into Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun, and, of course, Dr. No.
This was Ian Fleming's private beach at Goldeneye. He used to come down here every morning to swim before breakfast, before he started writing. And it was surely here that he got the inspiration for this extraordinary passage in Dr. No, which translated later into one of the most iconic images in the cinema. Bond's heart missed a beat and then began pounding so that he had to breathe deeply to quieten it. It was a naked girl with her back to him. She was not quite naked. She wore a broad leather belt round her waist with a hunting knife in a leather sheath at her right hip. The belt made her nakedness extraordinarily erotic. The whole scene, the empty beach, the green and blue sea, the naked girl with the strands of fair hair, reminded Bond of something. He searched his mind. Yes, she was Botticelli's Venus, seen from behind. So that's obviously me.
So after all his life, brewing up ideas, the book was written, and he was about to marry the woman he loved.
They got married here in Jamaica on the 24th of March, 1952. Noel Coward was one of the witnesses. Afterwards, they drank martinis, which Ian insisted should be made without bruising the gin. They ate a turtle, which Ian had caught, and black crab in its shell.
Leaving Jamaica the next day, they set off on their honeymoon. In his attaché case, Fleming carried the final draft of the first Bond book, Casino Royale. In London, their son Casper was born, and Fleming pushed to get his spy story published. After some persuasion, Jonathan Cape decided to print. Fleming threw himself into the launch, designing the book jacket and suggesting that the coronation made the title very marketable. Casino Royale was a hit. It was recorded that every 6.5 minutes, another copy was snapped up, and Jonathan Cape soon offered Fleming a 3-book deal. The best new thriller writer. Ian Fleming has discovered the secret of narrative art. It's all utterly disgraceful and highly enjoyable. Fleming had created an irresistible modern hero by mixing the dark world of espionage with the new desire for luxury and exoticism that he was experiencing as a journalist. Godfrey Smith worked with Fleming at the Sunday Times.
Godfrey, what was Ian Fleming like? Was he fun? Was he amusing and dashing?
He was certainly the most colourful person on the staff of the Sunday Times, almost mythological figure. He was a role model. I mean, the cars, caviar, girls. For us young chaps, the week's work on the Sunday Times ended in the small hours of Sunday morning, whereas Ian finished his week's work about Friday lunchtime, when he'd get into his Ford Thunderbird, cheerio chaps, and whiz off down to the country to get in 9 holes of golf before dinner. And that was a very Bond-like moment, I think, yes.
Fleming enjoyed a glamorous life, and his work at the Sunday Times further fueled a jet-set lifestyle. As foreign manager and travel writer, his large expense account offered exotic travel, gourmet dining, and sophisticated cocktails. These inspired Bond's tastes.
Beluga caviar, Dom Perignon 55, Monsieur Picard.
And Fleming pioneered descriptions of the new consumerism, technology, and cachet for brands pouring over from America. An intoxicating mix for his British readers.
Of course, at that time, it was a monochrome world, a rather drab world. The war was only just over. The country was absolutely flat. It was both bankrupt and whacked and tired. And anything that gave colour or excitement and exoticism to life was enormously welcome.
Fleming was not only exploiting the aspirations of the British people, but also their fears. His writing echoed the new era of unpredictability, filled with nuclear secrets, Cold War paranoia, defecting double agents, and their deadly hardware.
History is moving pretty quickly these days, and the heroes and villains keep changing parts. These politicians can't see that the atomic age has created the most deadly saboteur in the history of the world, the little man with the heavy suitcase.
Fleming was at the centre of this. As foreign manager, he ran a team of journalists around the world, many of whom had connections with the secret services. Their locations were indicated by flashing bulbs on a map behind his desk. It was their reports of the developing Cold War that led to Bond's new enemies, from Smersh to Spectre.
A photo of Fleming smiling.
Spurred on by the success of Casino Royale, Fleming produced a book a year. By the end of the 50s, the world was lapping up Live and Let Die, Moonraker, Diamonds Are Forever, From Russia with Love, and Goldfinger.
A helicopter comes in to land and Joanna gets out.
What I think makes the Bond book so utterly gripping is Fleming's obsession with detail. His skill was to take real information and put it into a fictional world. This came to be known as the Fleming effect. Each book was painstakingly researched. For instance, when he was writing Goldfinger, he had to know everything about gold. He even wanted to know whether gold had a smell. And when he was researching Diamonds Are Forever, he came to De Beers to get amongst the real stones.
Diamonds.
Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it.
What he now held had a heart of blue-white flame, and the infinite colours lanced into his eyes like needles. Now he could understand the passion that diamonds had inspired through the centuries, the almost sexual love they aroused. I don't
need love. Charlie Higson, the author of the Young Bond novels, a series about 007's teenage escapades, has studied Fleming's writing techniques.
Charlie, we're into beers with about 24 million pounds worth of diamonds racked up in front of us. Can I do this? I think I can. These are actually diamonds.
What does 24 million pounds worth of diamonds smell like?
I don't know, just the earth. They're only stones. They're only bits of coal.
I asked Charlie to tell me about the Fleming effect.
He could make everything exciting. Now, you can read thrillers which are non-stop, people shooting each other and things blowing up, which are quite dull. But Fleming could make a golf match exciting. Yeah. It goes on for about five chapters in Goldfinger, or a game of cards. And it's this specialist knowledge that brings each book alive, from, well, rocket science in Moonraker to the underwater scenes in Thunderball. Fleming's research is always so thorough and well-presented that the reader can become almost an expert themselves. Fleming was a big fan of the American thriller writing style, the hard-boiled style, and also the kind of brand fiction style, which anchors the fantastical elements in a more familiar reality.
If you're off on some tremendous plot with heaven knows what, James Bond in a hassle with some terrible villain, if he can use a Ronson lighter, let's say, or drive a Bentley motor car, or stay in the Ritz Hotel, this all brings the reader back to Earth.
Once Fleming had gleaned all the facts from the experts and worked them into the books, he sent the manuscript off to his editor, William Plumer, for his advice.
His editor was gay, and there's a weird pull in the books between Bond being this very hard, blunt instrument and his kind of interest in things like the type of cotton that his shirts are made of, how he likes his eggs done, this sort of slight kind of fussy maiden aunt type of approach to things. And a lot of that actually came from William Plumer himself, who would write the stuff in for him. There's a very amusing note here. As for the love scene, I really do think one can be too crude at times, and I don't think it's desirable. Far be it from me to write it for you, but there are points at which indecency occurs. Fancy writing that to the creator of James Bond. These notes are actually very extensive from the editor, but Fleming was happy about that. He was more than happy to get people who he considered to be experts to help him and give advice.
Fleming even ended up changing his books on account of his readers. He received hundreds of letters from helpful pedants pointing out any inaccuracies in his otherwise well-researched facts.
For instance, in the last book, the girl goes into the bar in the casino and orders half a bottle of Paul Roger champagne. Well, it turns out that the Paul Roger is the one champagne firm that doesn't turn out half bottles.
And if there was one area of a spy's life he had to get right, it was the weaponry.
He could see the black bullet lazily, like a slow flying bee, homing down into the valley towards a square of pink skin. There was a light smack as it hit. Who was this man he was going to do this to?
Joanna's fired a gun.
Of course, this is the ultimate Bond gadget, the gun. Fleming gave 007 one of these, a Beretta, in his first book, Casino Royale, assuming that it was the standard weapon issued to secret agents of that time, or possibly because he'd owned one when he was in naval intelligence. But he was criticised for it. He was told it was a lady's gun, and not really a very nice lady at that.
She strikes a pose and fires off another shot.
It was the firearm enthusiast Geoffrey Boothroyd who wrote to Fleming, saying that the Beretta pistol was not right for Bond. Fleming wrote back with polite enthusiasm, saying, "I'm most anxious to see that he lives as long as possible, and I shall be most grateful for any further technical advice."
As a result of this, we decided to rearm James Bond.
Walter PPK, 7.65 mil with a delivery like a brick through a plate glass window.
In thanks, Fleming made Major Boothroyd a character in Dr. No.
Thank you, Major Boothroyd.
Thank you, sir.
Bond was a phenomenal success, but not everyone was a fan. In an article written in the New Statesman shortly after the publication of Dr. No, Fleming was accused of writing about sex, snobbery, and sadism.
It is not only the immediate agony. but also the thought that your manhood is being gradually destroyed, and that at the end, you will no longer be a man. That, my dear Bond, is a sad and terrible thought.
Fleming rebuffed his critics and defended his use of such explicit descriptions of torture.
Particularly since the last war, we've all become much more educated in what really is violence and sadism and savagery and so on, and what technical tricks of torture and violence the Gestapo got up to, what the KGB gets up to now in Russia. It's ridiculous in this day and age to have one's hero hit over the head with a baseball bat. Wouldn't be contemporary writing at all.
The other main criticism weighed against Fleming was his utter obsession with sex. Fleming's wife, Anne, was embarrassed. She said she didn't want Fleming to dedicate a Bond book to her. She snubbed his writing by calling it mere pornography. Later, The Spy Who Loved Me got Fleming into particular trouble with the line, "All women love semi-rape." Samantha Weinberg, as the author of The Moneypenny Diaries, has a unique insight into Fleming's treatment of women in the Bond books.
One of the critics said about Fleming that it was the mechanical, two-dimensional sex longings of a frustrated adolescent. Do you think that's fair? Was he sinister, or was it all harmless fun?
I think a bit of both. I think there's something in the frustrated adolescent. I mean, I think that his very dominant mother possibly sort of arrested some of his development. He definitely projected some of his longings onto Bond.
There is something I'd like you to get off your chest.
It is undeniably sexist. There's a bit in Casino Royale, and Vesper has just been kidnapped. And Bond is cursing M for having sent her out. And he goes, "These blithering women who thought they could do a man's work, why the hell couldn't they stay at home and mind their pots and pans and stick to their frocks and gossip and leave men's work to the men?" I mean, really, that's completely not acceptable in any age, I don't think. But of course, we must remember the time this was written. This is still the early 1950s, and attitudes to women were very different to today. So I think the objections at the time were from rather hoity-toity reviewers who thought that this new kind of writing that flowered out of the post-war period was somehow not befitting of the time.
And I meant for warm-blooded heterosexual adults, you know, in beds and railway trains and aeroplanes. They're not meant for schoolboys.
When I was a Bond girl, there were 12 of us minor Bond girls. And it was very interesting because we were all pleased as punch. We were all liberated girls from the 60s. We all loved the freedom of the 60s and lived our lives accordingly, I would think. But there was something terribly thrilling about being chosen to be a Bond girl. There's something mesmeric about Bond, that the same enduring kind of sheen of Bondism still sticks to me now. The fact that I can say to people I was a Bond girl, and a flicker of respect. I only had two lines.
I'd give anything to be a Bond girl, even now.
I know.
Wouldn't we all? And that's the liberative women that we are.
What are the lovely names of the girls he chose?
There's Pussy Galore.
Yes.
Which is fantastic, because she was a lesbian gang leader from Chicago, I think. There was Solitaire. There was Domino, whose real name was Dominetta, which sounds quite like dominatrix. I'm sure that was right up his street. And wonderful, wonderful names. I mean, you remember them because of the names as much as their characters, which weren't, to be honest, fully fleshed out.
I think that's the trigger to how the books should be treated, you know. The names that he gives his villains and the names he gives his girls, they're so of heightened reality that we must know that he wasn't seriously a sinister man, I wouldn't have thought. He wasn't really writing serious sadomasochistic horror, although he was accused of it. He really wasn't.
He has one girl per book, approximately, and that's one a year. I think that's he's a bachelor, and he moves around the world pretty rapidly. I don't see any great harm in that myself.
The portrayal of guiltless sex in Fleming's novels was considered daring at the time, but of course was to become one of their strongest selling points, particularly when Bond hit the big screen. In 1961, Fleming signed a film deal with producers Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli that would immortalise his creation.
What's your name?
James.
For the first Bond film, Dr. No, Cubby Broccoli decided to cast Sean Connery, an almost unknown Scottish actor who'd previously worked as a milkman, coffin polisher, sailor, boxer and lifeguard. Fleming had lunch with Connery at the Savoy and was unconvinced that this overgrown stuntman was quite right for the part. His doubts were allayed when an attractive woman at the same lunch assured him that Connery had it. And sex appeal continues to be the main casting requirement for all subsequent Bonds.
What is it about Fleming's writing that's so compelling? The pull of Bond is still as magnetic as ever.
Bond is a very malleable cultural figure in lots of ways. He's an empty figure, Bond.
Yes, how interesting. So you can fill him up, you can imagine what you want him to be like.
He's a repository for your dreams. He has no family. He has no wife.
No.
He has no real employer apart from a rather shadowy secret network behind him.
Although Bond has got some, and Fleming picks them out quite clearly, unpleasant qualities about him, a kind of cruelty that is always ever-present. Women always love a bit of a devil.
Absolutely.
And like somebody who knows how to do things, but it's just a little bit of a snake. A little bit dangerous.
You're not meant to like Bond, I don't think, but you can't help falling in love with him.
Yeah.
And that's often a slightly different thing, and I think that's his great charm, and that, in a way, is, I think, why the character has endured so well.
Today, more than half the world's population has seen at least one Bond film. Millions will see Quantum of Solace, which continues the high-octane adventures with the latest Bond, Daniel Craig.
Bond is back.
The films made Ian Fleming a worldwide celebrity. But ironically, just as the Bond phenomenon was taking off, pressures on Fleming's marriage, writing and health were coming to the fore. Fleming and Anne's fiery relationship cooled as the day-to-day realities of married life polarised their differences. Anne enjoyed entertaining London's literary elite. Ian was happier playing golf with his friends at his home from home, the Royal St George's Golf Course in Kent. I've come here to meet Fionn Morgan, Fleming's stepdaughter, Anne's daughter from her first marriage.
The relationship between your mother and Ian went on for 30 years. What was it like?
It was at its height, really, I think, sort of before the marriage, unfortunately. When they were in Jamaica, my mother calls Ian, you know, Adam in this Eden. So that was a dream time.
They sound as though they're quite a sort of a lively couple. Did they argue much?
They were a lively couple, and towards the end, they argued like billio. My mother had rather sort of grotty car, and they went to stay at a rather beautiful place called Merriworth Castle. They had a frightful row at the bridge table. And so my mother was so cross with Ian, she got up, she'd drive back to London, and she drove it as hard as she could into the Thunderbird, and I'm afraid left a rather big kiss on the Thunderbird.
Ultimately, the marriage fell apart, and they both conducted affairs. But when separated, they still missed each other painfully, he declaring, "I love you only in the world."
He was the love of her life, really.
Definitely the love of her life. Definitely.
How do you think success affected Ian? Do you think when he was a writer it brought him happiness?
At first, I think it brought him great happiness. I think it didn't last forever, but the beginning was very exciting. But towards the end, there's a letter to my mother which I'm afraid says, "I'm getting so tired of that ass Bond." You know, I mean,
To his fans' dismay, he nearly finished off Bond as early as 1957, leaving him poisoned at the end of From Russia with Love. He would later write,
"I am terribly stuck with James Bond. I used to believe, sufficiently, in blondes and bombs. Now the keys creak as I type, and I fear the zest may have gone. I shall definitely kill off Bond with my next book."
Fleming never carried out his threat. But the sheer pressure of the endless research, writing and promotion of each book was wearing him down.
By the time Fleming had written his ninth Bond book, Thunderball, published in 1961,
James Bond was ailing. Fleming's report on the health of his hero was broadly autobiographical. The drinking, the high blood pressure, the headaches were all suffered with increasing persistence by the writer himself. This is how Thunderball starts. It was one of those days when it seemed to James Bond that all life, as someone put it, was nothing but a heap of 6-4 against. Sadly, just as Ian Fleming was beginning to enjoy the heights of his success, ill health was taking its toll on him.
Fleming would not heed the doctor's advice. In typical Bond-like fashion, Fleming's prescription was to carry on chain-smoking and drinking industrial quantities of gin. He saw no point in living if he couldn't live the way he pleased. Ill health would not stop him writing either. Following a major heart attack in 1961, Fleming was consigned to bed. Forcing him to rest, Anne confiscated his typewriter, but Fleming continued nonetheless. He began to write and illustrate by hand a story for their son, Casper, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. In many ways, this is the ultimate Bond story for children, with a flying car and a recipe for fudge instead of martini. In spite of all the pressures he was facing, Fleming was still able to travel to Jamaica, research You Only Live Twice in Japan, and write 5 more books. With one last courageous effort in January 1964, Fleming tapped out the first draft of The Man with the Golden Gun. Where once he stormed through 2,000 words a morning, he was now writing painfully, a little over an hour a day.
007.
Later that year, the film Goldfinger was released, but Ian Fleming would never see it. On August the 12th, 1964, after coming here to his beloved Royal St George's golf course, his heart finally failed him. Ian Fleming died at the age of 56. By pouring all his memories, opinions, loves and experiences into his books, The Adventures of James Bond are, albeit with a poetic license, the fantasy biography of Ian Fleming. He had succeeded in his lifelong ambition to become a best-selling, internationally renowned writer. Until the end, his life was dedicated to blending fiction with reality for the enjoyment of the world.
I want a temperature of 80 degrees in the shade, to be able to work there and look at the flowers and birds and fish, and somehow to give pleasure, whether innocent or illicit, to people in their millions.
I wish I'd met him. Such a complicated and fascinating man, looking at life with such an wry and amused smile, having a go at things, really attacking it, living life to the full. A short-ish life, but flat out, just what I love. This is what he said about writing. Above all, being a comparatively successful writer is a good life. You don't have to work at it all the time, and you can carry your office around in your head. And you're far more aware of the world around you. Writing makes you more alive to your surroundings. And since the main ingredient of living is to be alive, that is quite a worthwhile byproduct. Even if you only write thrillers, whose heroes are white, villains black, and the heroines a delicate shade of pink.
One life for yourself and one for your dream.